to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. We are, of course, live from the Kintech Studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. And right now, we are very pleased to be joined on the phone by our Sportsnet colleague. He is Ian McIntyre. iMac, thank you as always for making time for us. How are you?
I'm doing well. I was madly looking for my ear pods. Can't find them, so I'm going to hold the phone up to my head for the next 20 minutes.
Old school. That old journalist know-how.
Way to play hurt, buddy.
old school. When you've been around as long as I have, old school, believe me, is a lot older than holding a cell phone to your head.
Indeed. So we're five games into this six-game homestand. Obviously, they'll finish up against the Rangers tomorrow. 2-3 record, and kind of, I think it's fair to say, I'm probably understating it here, underwhelming performance from the Canucks so far in these five games. Looking at this kind of stretch in total, what would you say has been kind of the chief flaw for the Canucks over this homestand so far?
Well, obviously they haven't played close to their best. I mean, the Calgary game was pretty good. The Chicago game, they just did what they had to beat a poor team. But they haven't come close to their best. And you know, I think it's a little more disconcerting because we saw in October, even though they were piling up wins, they were rarely at their best as well. But it felt like progress was being made. You know, however incrementally, they seem to be moving forward. And then on the last road trip in California with the sweep, and two of their best games of the season against Anaheim and L.A., probably the L.A. game, their best game of the season, then to come back home and regress is a little bit disconcerting. And there's lots of reasons why they haven't been at their best, but I think, you know, superficially, just looking at their players, how are they ever going to be their best if Pettersson and JT Miller are not at their best simultaneously? And that's what we haven't seen. When Miller was playing pretty well, despite whatever his undisclosed issue is that stemmed from training camp and kept him out of all but the final preseason game, he was playing pretty well. And Elias Pettersson, we could hardly find. And now Pettersson's actually playing really well. That's one of the few positives I think about this homestand is his play. Now that he's playing well, JT Miller's sitting on the bench. And so the Canucks, and last night, you know, one of the things Tockett said is they need more plays from their top players. Brock Besser's out, of course. Thatcher Demko is still out. They just haven't had their top players making enough plays. And yes, all the other things that we talk about, the systems play, the depth, the structure, you know, Kevin Lankinen's goaltending has been a huge positive for the team this season. All that said, like most teams, eventually your top players are going to dictate how good or not the team is going to be. And right now, the top players haven't been good enough as a group.
What did you make of the JT Miller benching last night, iMac, especially in the context of, you know, some of Tockett's commentary, I think, leading up to following the Islanders game, you know, the I've been too soft, on and on. Do you see this as sort of a continuation of that, like a coach just grasping for something to motivate his group?
Yeah, I wouldn't say grasping, because I don't think Tockett is quite at that desperation level yet. But I do think it is a move that is broader than simply discontent with how JT Miller was playing in that game. And he wasn't very good. And you know, especially the penalty kill at the end of the second period, he was one of the killers on the ice for Vancouver, and the whole group was kind of just seemed mixed up. You know, they allowed the seam pass and the goal. I don't think that one play necessarily is what got JT Miller only two shifts in the third period, but I think it contributed to it. But I think playing him, the least ice time that he has logged as a Vancouver Canuck, also sends the message to the rest of the team. There's a trickle-down effect. And I do think not that you know, you would play games with a possible win or loss simply to try to manipulate a statement. But I do think that the reason we may see JT Miller benched with less latitude than, say, Elias Pettersson getting benched, which we didn't see when Pettersson, for the most part, I mean, Pettersson's ice time was up and down, but we never saw him play 11 minutes and change when he was struggling, I think is because Tocchet realizes that JT Miller can handle this and that it's not going to cause some fracture that, you know, in the dressing room or ruin a coach-player relationship. I think there's a lot of trust between Miller and Tocchet and a lot of respect. And so I think it's a move that Tocchet can make that sends a message to Miller, sends a message to the team, and really doesn't carry much spillover risk, although we're all going to be talking about it the rest of this week, but it doesn't carry much spillover risk for causing further damage to the team. And Miller himself, if he had spoken to us last night, he probably would have said, I'm not good enough. Mm. And because he said it in the past, and he said it in games where he was better than what he was last night. So I think it's a reflection of a team that it has stalled and a coach that is less willing in mid-November than he was, say, in late October to just accept all this without making some sort of statement.
Do you get a sense of joylessness when you think about what this Canucks team has put on tape? Like, I mean, has there been a game you'd have described as fun?
Oh, let me think about that. I mean, certainly on the road, yes. Like on the road after some of the games, like after the LA game, there was, you know, the dressing room was ebullient. You know, it was, guys were happy. They knew that they'd accomplished something, not just that game, but the sweep. Now I'm quickly checking through my Yeah, there has been the Philadelphia, the game in Philadelphia, the Tyler Myers game.
Yeah,
that was a great night.
That's a good point
for the team and the players. It's just there's been very few of those games at home. I mean, even the Calgary game. The Calgary game wasn't, you know, a 9 out of 10 performance, but it was a good performance that I think seemed even better because it had come, you know, after the clunker against Edmonton, not long after the clunker against New Jersey. And so I think it sort of had heightened value as a game. And I know the players were satisfied, but, you know, joyful, I don't think they were. I don't think there's been much joy in Vancouver. And ultimately, that's a problem because it's an entertainment business. If you're going to have duds, which is what Tocchet has called these, you'd rather have your duds on the road than have them on home ice on a Saturday night. So, you know, it's an issue for them going forward. Even if they beat the Rangers tomorrow, and the Rangers are their, you know, the toughest opponent that they've seen on this trip, this homestand, in which they're already 2-3. Even if they beat the Rangers, it's been kind of a lost opportunity here at home, and it's something they're going to have to continue to deal with after their next road trip.
You know, the other thing, just thinking a little bit more about JT Miller here, iMac, I do think it's not a coincidence that this kind of stretch of downplay coincides with Brock Besser being out of the lineup. And, you know, not to try to put a positive spin on this or anything, but look, we all know how good a player Besser is. He scored 40 goals last year, but I wonder if this is maybe giving us all a chance to kind of reassess not just his talent as an individual player, but how important he has been to making that line, that duo with JT Miller click. I mean, I think we tend to look at, you know, the fact that JT Miller's the center and the point totals he puts up and kind of think, okay, Miller's driving that line. But I wonder if this is maybe giving us a bit of an opportunity to, as I said, reassess what Besser's doing and contributing to that partnership too.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, as is the positive-negative spin. I think we all want to be realistic, but I don't think you should be afraid to have some positive spin, since we never are shy about having negative spin. So everything balances out. But I think you know, Brock Besser has been acknowledged for a while now as a superior two-way winger in this league, and that we know that wasn't the case early on. He's easily the best winger that this team has. And realistically, you can't take him out of the lineup and replace him with 20-year-old Jonathan Lekkerimäki. I was about to say Lekkerimäki. So that's another one I'm trying to change. Lekkerimäki. You can't put in a 20-year-old rookie who's never played in the NHL, no matter how offensively talented he may be and what a promising future he may have as a scorer. But he would be, you know, he's the equivalent of when Brock Besser first came out of college and could score goals, but wasn't nearly the player that he is now. And in a few years, I'm sure that Lekkerimäki is going to be a far more well-rounded player than he is now. And by the way, I'm not saying this is because Lekkerimäki's playing with Miller that Miller's struggling.
Right.
You know, but you make a good point. You can't take Brock Besser out of the lineup or away from any winger and not have it make a difference.
Does that then recontextualize the Pettersson conversation from last year?
How much
are we going to recontextualize here?
but you know what? Elias has had every winger at some point.
Yes.
Right? I mean, they basically ran through the roster when Elias was struggling to try and get him, you know, wingers who would work, even to the point, you know, at times they took away wingers who were doing really well on other lines to try to, quote, as Tockett said, and I'm thinking especially when Garland was moved to Pettersson's line early in season to get Elias going. So, you know, talent matters. And again, Brock Besser is the best winger that this team has. And no matter who he's going to play with, that center is going to miss him when he's out.
When you think about some of the flat performances we've seen on this homestand, do you think it's more like a vibes issue, which is largely what we've been talking about with you so far over 15 minutes? Or do you think it's more, or do you think we should give more credence to the hockey side of it? The, you know, second pair issue, some of the stuff that we're seeing in terms of how this team actually plays.
Yeah, I think it's got more to do with simple execution and as we've been talking about, to some degree, talent level. Now, the team should be good enough, even without Brock, that they play better in some of these games. But I don't see it as much as, you know, the guys aren't having fun, and that's a negative cycle that then leads to more not having fun, and even when they win, they're not joyless. I don't think it's that. I think they've got enough guys now who understand what it takes to win, enough players, and including the entire core group from last year, who learned what you had to do to be a 51-win, 109-point team, and they understand that they're not doing those things. And I think that's where the joylessness is. I don't think it's about a mix of players. I don't think it's about, you know, the coach or even just losing. I think it's that they know that they have better in them and they haven't produced it. But to get that better out of them, you have to play and execute with a lot more focus, discipline, and consistency than what they have shown. And, you know, maybe the troubling part is, you know, that those kind of things you think are a baseline, right? The effort level and the execution with so many players back, although, you know, they have another huge swath of of the roster that's new this year. And that's, I think that's another issue, but a secondary one, but that is an issue too. But they have enough players back, and they have enough players who genuinely are driven to prove that last season was not a one-off and that it wasn't an overachievement and that it was actually a launching point where this group can be, as every organization hopes to be, a group that can challenge annually for a Stanley Cup after they make the playoffs. You would think with all those players and all that drive and understanding and know-how from last season that maybe the things as simple as effort and basic execution and adherence to a system shouldn't be the issue that it's proving to be in this season now, almost a quarter of the way through the year.
One of the, of course, the big storyline so far this year is the absence of Thatcher Demko, and official updates or timelines pretty hard to come by. It seems like maybe we're getting closer to a Thatcher Demko return and him getting a start at some point here. But I think we also know it's not just going to be, okay, he's healthy now, and now he's, you know, taking on typical Thatcher Demko workload. What's your kind of sense of what we should expect from the Canucks goaltending situation, you know, in the kind of medium term here, if Demko's able to get back soon and then they start the process of kind of ramping him up?
Yeah, well, I think, and I've said before, and I understand why there's so much focus on when Thatcher Demko will play, because this has dragged out way longer than any of us thought last spring. I mean, and even, you know, when Demko met the media and had that great, honest press conference in Penticton on day one of training camp, it sure felt like, okay, we're going to see this guy in some form, even if it's just practicing, you know, when the season starts. And here we are, middle of November, we're only seeing him now, just in the last week, do anything that's close to a full practice. So I understand we're all wondering when he's going to play. But I've said that I think the bigger question is, how do you make sure when he does return that he's going to be in a position to play well and stay healthy? Like, to me, there's no issue about eventually he's going to come back and play, but we've seen in the past when he came back, and particularly the disastrous year 2 years ago, when he came back from injury and missed time and then got hurt, you know, struggled badly and then got hurt again. I think that's the bigger issue. And I think the team is aware of that as well. And, you know, it is a different landscape for goalies now with the goaltending coach change. I think this management group, it takes a more proactive approach to things perhaps than the past. So I think there is a lot of time and energy right now being put into not just getting him back, but making sure when he comes back, he's in a position to succeed. And so what does that mean for the goaltender? I mean, it's going to be an upgrade no matter what. Because right now, looking at it in the simplest terms, when Thatcher Demko comes back, Artur Silovs is going to the American Hockey League. So is Thatcher Demko going to be an upgrade on Artur Silovs? Of course he is. Of course he is. I think the really positive part of the situation, because Kevin Lankinen has played so well, is that Thatcher Demko doesn't have to come back like he did from his injury 2 years ago, or even from his injury at the end of last season before Silovs has had its breakthrough. Doesn't have to come back and be the guy who's leaned on to play five out of every six games. I don't think that's going to happen initially. I think Lankinen has shown enough that he gives the Canucks the luxury of easing, if that's not too strong a word to describe it, easing Thatcher Demko back in and allowing Demko to kind of build his game back, which is what I think he's going to have to do. I don't think he's going to, when Thatcher comes back, no matter how careful they are about putting him in a position to succeed, I don't think he's going to be Vezina Trophy runner-up Thatcher Demko right away. But with the way that Lankinen has played, he doesn't have to be. As long as he can work his way back to that form and stay healthy, by the end of the year, they're going to be in a superb position goaltending-wise.
How's the phone holding arm holding up?
That right elbow's a little bit tight. I may need some physio. I'm also, I don't know if you can hear, I'm outside in my neighborhood, and the garbage truck just came by, so I've been walking around. I may be out of breath as well, but it's nice. The sun is out. It's a beautiful day.
There you go.
I'm talking to you guys. What could be better?
I can think of at least one thing at the end there. It would be better for you, but everything else sounds lovely.
Is it riding on the garbage truck?
Oh, how cool would that be?
The best, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I knew Mac would pick up the wonderment of what I was suggesting.
You know what I've thought is, because it would be so cool to ride on the back of a fire truck, but that has so many more weighty responsibilities,
yes, mm-hmm,
than just riding on the back of the garbage truck. And I mean no slight to our sanitation workers.
Absolutely not.
That would be fun. I'm so old school. We started this with an old school mention. I'm so old school that when I was a kid in the 1970s, I remember our postman would give kids a ride in his mail truck. We'd
That's
go around
awesome.
The neighborhood in the mail truck. In a more innocent time, I'm sure.
Yeah, that they're not doing that these days. That's awesome.
No, without
being arrested.
No, nor would any parent want their kids to. But back then, it was like, parents, okay, you leave the house at 8 in the morning, you get back maybe at dinner time, and you know, as long
go
as
go for a ride with the mailman in between. What's not to like?
When you get home, you can flip through some Richard Scarry and imagine all the things, all the places you could go.
Things that go.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I know. And Dr. Seuss.
I'm Mac. Always great, man. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me on. That was fun.
That is Sportsnet's Ian McIntyre. That Insider brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. Shout out to iMac for making some time for us. And by the way, I did see, I think it was Darren Dreger today, who says that Demko's return sooner rather
imminent.
Than later. Yes, potentially imminent. So, you know, they've got what, two games in the next 8 days here, right? So if they get through those two games, then does Thatcher Demko become a possibility at some point on their road trip out east? We'll see. I mean, it's the kind of thing where I don't want to like pencil it in at any point until it's actually happening, because it has been such a strange injury. But you continue to hear just kind of that drip, drip, drip of some positive signs for Thatcher Demko.
Yeah, and then we'll have a whole host of new uncertainty and questions to ask, like how often will
yep.
he play?
Mm-hmm.
Right, on and on. So, look, great sign for Demko. You hate to see a guy at his level miss out on the playoffs the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously to hear about all that he went through this summer, I'm sure it'll be a huge lift for the team. And you know, look, one thing too, Demko, usually when guys get hurt, they're out of sight, out of mind, away from the club. He has been around this team the entire process, you know, that to me just speaks to what I'm sure is a desperation level to get back to doing what he loves and works so hard to do well. Not just well. Better than just about anyone
very high level
on the planet.
All right, we'll take a break. More Canucks talk coming up. We got a full hour open. Just me and Drance on the other side. So everyone's thrilled for that. Get your texts in.
Mostly you.
I want to talk a little bit about the salary cap, and then, of course, lots of other Canucks stuff as well coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Miss any part of Halford and Brough in the Morning? Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and don't miss an episode.
Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, is powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and lots of thoughts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Yeah, just a level of discontent and frustration right now that's pretty high amongst our listeners, at least, and I think Canucks fans in general. So we'll dive into the inbox at some point here. I did want to talk a little bit about one of our show's perennial favorite topics, which is, of course, the NHL salary cap, Drancer. And we have a clip. Producer Dom, on his other job, they were talking about this as well, of course, if you hadn't heard. Dom produces 32 Thoughts for Sportsnet as well.
Small publication.
Yes, maybe you've heard of it. Not a big deal. Dom never brings it up, so you'd be forgiven if you didn't know, but Dom does that as well. Anyways.
Yeah, Dom never pretends to be super busy because of his 32 Thoughts responsibilities.
Elliot Friedman talking about the NHL salary cap and the potential for a very significant increase over the next couple of years. Potentially, we're talking here, and there's a lot of wrinkles, there's a lot of stuff to get into, but here's first Elliot Friedman on 32 Thoughts talking about that.
The cap right now probably should be in the $100 million range. However, as long as this CBA is in place, those guardrails about the cap are still there. It could only go up 5% this year, and it could only go up 5% next year. It's supposed to be around 92.5. Now, there is a provision that if both sides agree, they could raise it higher. For example, this season, it was supposed to be 87.7, and the league said, you know what, let's bump it another 300,000. The players proposed raising it higher. The league rounded it up to 88. There have been times in the past couple of years where the players have said, look, the cap should be higher. Let's raise it higher. And first the league said, no, not until it was all paid off. And now it sounds like everybody's in position to go a little bit higher. The cap right.
So that's a little snippet from Elliot Friedman. And basically the gist of it is, and it's complicated, right? But that there was these provisions put in place for COVID, right? That the cap wouldn't go down, even though revenue would go down because no fans were allowed to go to games. And then that would create a debt that the players owed to the owners. They would slowly pay that debt back. And then you also had these 5% increases at a certain point built in. And basically what's happened is revenue has grown more than they thought it would, I think, post-pandemic. And you're at a point now where, as Friedman said, if it was just purely a 50-50 split without these COVID provisions in place, the cap would probably be at $100 million, right? So is there a chance that, and now the other part of this is that once the CBA expires, those 5% caps on an increase go away, right? And at that point, you could have a situation, you know, akin to the old NBA situation where the salary cap goes from like $95 million to $110 million in one offseason. And so basically,
which is something we've been talking about,
yes.
the Timofey Mozgov.
So basically what we're talking about here effect. Is smoothing. Instead of having that one offseason with like a 15 yep. to 16 to 17 million increase, do you try to smooth it out, get ahead of it now? And the upshot of that would be instead of a $92 million salary cap next year, are you looking at like a $96, $97 million salary cap next year, which is a massive difference.
Yes.
That's doubling the increase. That is a huge, that's almost a $10 million increase in the salary cap. Now, and Friedman lays out all these caveats as well, of course, and we always do whenever we talk about salary cap increases, right? It's never official until it's official. You don't know where it's going. There's things that can happen. There's the regional sports network issue. There's all of these things out there.
Everyone remembers the $87 or $88 million yep. projection on March 6th of 2020, right? Only for us to still not be at that level
yep.
5 years later. So.
Yep. Yeah. Right. So there's always things that can go wrong. But I do think it's fascinating to consider the implications of the cap going up to $97 million as soon as next season, right? And especially if teams start to really think that's going to be the case, what the implications of that are, what it means for the Canucks, right? And not just what it means going into next year, but even what it means in the here and now, right? I mean, the obvious first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people is probably the Brock Besser contract talks, right?
Oh, man.
Now, that's health things and everything. But as I was saying to IMAC, like, even him being out of the lineup, it's not exactly hurting his case right now.
No.
In fact, it's helping it. He looks even more valuable than he did when he was in the lineup and playing well as a result of his absence right now.
I mean, guys like him and Ekblad and Marner, who are also, like, still a couple of years south of 30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, just ka-ching. And also, really, I think teams have been anticipating this and behaving accordingly for a while, in that you've seen this rush to get long-term deals done.
Yep.
With a lot of top players. I mean, this UFA class could have been loaded. And by the way, you've also seen a few players, not a lot, but you've seen a few players also sort of swerve and prefer short-term deals, like Vladislav Gavrikov. I mean, how much money did he earn himself?
Mm-hmm.
By signing a two-year deal and then playing really, really well.
Yeah,
I mean, good Lord. Because if we're talking about a salary cap in that range, in that mid-90s range, I mean, the valuations we're going to see on what is, frankly, a pretty weak UFA class.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, I say a pretty weak UFA class. I also expect guys like Mikko Rantanen to just stay.
Of course, yeah.
It could obviously be more or less robust, depending on exactly how this all plays out. And then, of course, the other part of this is you still do need to be mindful of how volatile cap growth is, right? And this is like point number one. I think it's a good bet that the salary cap is going to grow massively for next season. Maybe you want to get really bullish and be like, we project a good amount of
two
cap growth for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Once you're getting into three or four, it's like, hey, you know, give me your stock tips too.
Yeah.
Because
the 2 years, I think, is most, you're most certain about betting on it because of the CBA thing.
Yeah.
Right. And again, you listen to 32 Thoughts, but basically.
But it's not, for me, it's not about the CBA.
What's it about?
It's about, I mean, unless the new CBA untethers the level of the cap from revenue, then you're always going to be vulnerable to whatever shock hits the wider economic climate.
For sure. But I think the point is that the smoothing could be part of getting the CBA done, right? So you're going to kind of set these levels as part of getting the CBA done,
right,
and stick with it.
And that was another idea that actually that famous Board of Governors meetings that I just referenced at mm-hmm. the BOG, they actually suggested the idea of like having multi-year, like setting the cap on a multi-year span and using escrow to normalize it, right? But you could have like, hey, we know it's going to be this. We mm-hmm. know it's going to be this the next year, and we know it's going to be this the next year. And that is something the league needs more than anything, in my opinion. Because
Certainty.
Because that would actually impact teams' planning. The people who actually, like the bean counters that actually manage caps, these are the most risk-averse people you'll ever meet. For good reason. They're always worried.
Mm-hmm.
You'd always rather budget and then find you have more cap space than the opposite, right? That's how this works. And, you know, more than half of the years since the hard cap era came into being, the league has had no cap growth, right? You had the economic downturn in 2008, right? The Great Recession, as we remember it. Then you had another labor stoppage in 2013, which artificially clawed back the salary cap. Then you had those 2 years where, for some reason, I don't remember the exact reason, but the value of the Canadian dollar went in the tank. Do you remember that? And
yes.
Everyone, like, literally overnight, we were late in the season. The Canucks did the Derek Dorsett deal and the Lucas Spezza extension.
Ugh.
And like, overnight, the league was projecting cap growth, and then there was none. It happened so suddenly. And then obviously you had the revenue sapping pandemic. There you go. Like, just there, you have 10 years of the 22 years of the hard cap era in which the cap hasn't grown. And then you've had others where it grows 12 million. Like, mm-hmm. you know, first year of the cap era was $38 million cap. I mean, it's wild to think. So while I think you can be aggressive in cap planning for growth and excited to, like, I'm excited personally for the idea that we will be able to be a little bit less like belt tightened in terms of our own analysis, like just for you and I, our own analysis of like the cost benefit of doing every deal you do. I do think we'll get to a world too where, for example, for most of the flat cap era, like 80% of the league was available for free.
Yep.
At any point on the trade market, that should change. Like, team player quality should matter an awful lot more.
And I actually think that might be the most interesting impact over the next few months as we go into trade season.
Yes.
Because all of a sudden, I think depending on how willing teams are to bet on, not even the like, oh, and then it's going to keep going up 10% every year, but just it's going to get to, you know, 105 million in 2 years, right? If you're willing to bet on that, I think that radically changes how you look at players with term.
I also think it should radically change how like a seller team values a guy like Frank Vetrano, right? Because in the hard cap era, not the hard cap, the flat cap era, it's like, okay, Frank Vetrano, we really like him. He's a solid second line winger. Maybe he's a third line winger on an elite team. Can we afford him at this stage of our team building cycle versus, you know, taking, you know, three shots on 800K guys that could hit, blah, blah, blah. Now it's like, okay, if we sell Frank Vetrano, replacing him is going to cost double, you know, and we actually have the space now to afford luxury items. Should we just keep him ourselves? Is he more valuable to us than the third round pick we'd get back from or the second round pick we'd get back from? You know, that calculus, I think, should be could massively change the calculus for some seller teams.
I think the other thing, right? So, I mean, as we focus in on maybe some like Canucks relevant targets here, but obviously like Rasmus Anderson are already insanely valuable. But if you think the cap's going to be $97 million and you have him at 4.55 next year, like that's a phenomenal asset all of a sudden. The other guys I would point out
The biggest Canucks impact though.
Yeah.
The biggest Canucks impact by far is this team was slated with the jump in the OEL buyout hit and the second year of Ilya Mikheyev's retained salary transaction to have something like $5 million in dead space, right? Now, if the cap goes up $5 million, that means everyone else gets space and the Canucks don't, basically, because you've got this sort of number that jumps significantly and almost all of the cap growth in the system doesn't benefit Vancouver. Well, if you're going up 10, if you're going up $8 million, something like that, I mean, it's still
your dead cap percentage is way less than it would have been.
Yeah. And you have to remember that this is an efficiency contest. We're still talking about a scarce resource environment from a cap perspective. But the fact that you might smooth or have this sort of rapid growth accelerate this quickly would at least somewhat cushion the blow of all of Vancouver's opponents getting to benefit from this growth environment and Vancouver sort of being a little bit left behind, a little bit like the Miss Squidward in the meme, right? Like looking at the teams having fun down below.
The other two names.
I know you love my SpongeBob references
so much. The other two names that jump to mind for me, again, as I try to think just like what could this do to the trade market? And of course, we're always focused on the blue line with the Canucks. The two names that jump to mind for me are Mackenzie Weegar and Colton Parayko, right? And I think...
Well, Parayko, you know, is a longtime favorite of mine.
Yes, but I think like, okay, name players, obviously, but long-term. And we're so used to... So Weegar is 6.25 until 2031. Parayko, 6.5 until 2030. And we've been so conditioned over the last 4+ years now that term is death for trade. Like, oh, that guy's long term. No, they're not. It's impossible to move. No team wants to take it. It's so awkward. All of that, right? Who would take on that term? I think the cap significantly, and like not just, oh, hey, it went up $4 million this year, but like really jumping over the next couple of years. I think it dramatically changes that conversation. And I wonder if it makes trades for players like that more palatable to teams. Now, the flip side of that is it makes them more valuable in the market, right? So it's not as if like all of a sudden, oh, hey, well, you go out and get those players for not that much because it can rehabilitate their value. But I think it should make teams much more willing to stomach that type of long-term risk if you think these significant increases are coming, right? And so I just think it widens the pool of players that could potentially be on the move that could be potential solutions for teams like the Canucks that are looking for help in certain departments. Like that's a kind of a big picture take, right? I mean, overall, I think it just greases the wheels on player movement. And that means there's more legitimate targets out there for teams.
100%. I will say though, like I like the Parayko bet period, but That to me, the scenario you just outlined to me, that is where the mistakes are going to be made, in my opinion. That is the dangerous ground where you're taking on a long-term deal and assuming that cap growth, like Like, but I think trusting the cap growth environment will cushion
I don't
the risk.
Think you need it to go like I don't think you need it to keep increasing over the life of the contract, though. You
right.
know what I mean? I think it needs to take the big jump over the next 2 years, and then you can live with those commitments.
Right.
Even if it's relatively flat after that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's how I would frame it. Like, all of a sudden, if it's a $105 million cap, like, a $6 million commitment looks way different than it does right now. Way different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's also where an awful lot of the deals signed with flat cap math. You know what I mean?
Start to come off, and yeah, and the guys start to look for like that's
those are where deals are just going
to
look
like
steals. Because
you start
like
to look
steals.
Ahead, and somebody texted in like, I don't even want to think about what Quinn Hughes's number is going to be if this happens. Well, like Quinn Hughes and Cale McCarr are UFAs the same summer,
yeah,
and it would be like after this increase has happened,
yeah,
like, that could be pretty startling.
That could be pretty startling, and meanwhile you've got Quinn's brother Jack Hughes at eight,
yeah,
forever. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. through what past 2030. I mean, that's...
When did he sign that, though? He signed that...
It's definitely past 2030, man. It was an 8-year deal signed...
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, it expires in 2030.
In 2030.
So you've got the rest of the decade with...
Yeah.
Jack Hughes at 8.
Million.
You know, I mean...
It's pretty good.
That's going to be... Some of those teams that really locked up those second contract guys long are going to have huge edges here. Right? Can you imagine? So, like, for example, if the Canucks had never done a bridge for Pettersson,
mm-hmm.
and it had ended up with something like 9 or 10. I mean, look, it's only 11.6. Like, it's not a huge difference. But say they'd ended up with 9.5, and you had 5 years left on that
mm-hmm.
with this sort of cap growth. I mean, or if they'd done Quinn long, even if they'd gone up to
got the 2 extra years for him,
even yep. if they'd gone to 9, 9.5, 10, who cares? But of course, we only don't care because Quinn Hughes has become
yes.
this, which you know wasn't necessarily foreseeable. At the time that he did his deal. Although, man, who else would you bet on?
Yeah, seriously. And I don't want, like, I know fans have started texting in occasionally about the Quinn Hughes next contract. I don't really want to start going down that road. It's kind of just like,
we've got so much time.
Either you give him whatever he wants or he decides to go play with his brothers, but like, yeah. whatever. I don't know.
Also, this team's good right now.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Well, also, we get to spend less time talking about like league economics and
yes.
how to take advantage of it, because in the here and now, this team has potentially a shot to do something special if they start, you know, playing a little bit better than they have the last 10 games.
And potentially make some moves, right? And just to kind of
yep.
connect the salary cap and my point about, okay, maybe the universe of potential acquisitions is maybe a little bit larger than it has been in recent seasons in the NHL. The team, I've been starting to think a lot about the 2015-2016 Pittsburgh Penguins right now. And the reason for that is, and this is something we've talked about, right? The Jim Rutherford approach with that team that, of course, goes on to win the Stanley Cup. It wasn't, okay, let's make some moves around the margins at the trade deadline. It was kind of ongoing, repeated hockey trades to change the makeup of the team, right? And it was December 14th that season, they traded Rob Scuderi for Trevor Daley. Scuderi was like playing significant minutes for them. January 16th, they traded David Perron and Adam Klidenning for Carl Hagelin. Perron was playing significant minutes for them before the trade. They make a more traditional deadline deal for Justin Schultz in February. And I just am starting to kind of wonder if that's more what we're likely to see with the Canucks this year then. And we saw it a little bit last year, right? Like, obviously, they do the Zadorov deal in November. They get ahead of the trade deadline with the Lindholm deal towards the end of January. But as we mentioned earlier, right, Elliot Friedman saying, hey, they're going to make a move on the blue line. It's just a question of when. And I threw in the kind of thing of, okay, well, how many moves did they make, right? Is this a one deadline deal acquisition and you think you're done type of situation on the blue line? Or is this something that could demand a little bit more major surgery or a few moves, a few hockey trades, things like that? And Jim Rutherford has the track record of doing it. He's done it in the past, right? He's not afraid to do that kind of remodeling on the fly, retooling on the fly in some ways of a team, even a good team, throughout the course of the year. And look, I'm not saying, hey, they're going to trade Carson Soucy. He's got a no trade clause anyway, so it would be very difficult to do. But I just think maybe we have to start thinking a little bit more about, Are there some unconventional types of trades, right? Is this going to be as simple as find expiring guy X and flip some futures for him and that's the fix? Or are they going to have to think a little bit more outside the box here? And I think the longer of it, this kind of malaise that the team is in continues and the Susie Myers pairing continues to struggle as well, the more we should expect some of those types of moves from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Elvin at some point.
Yeah. No, look, it's going to be a really interesting next few months. There's so many teams that need exactly what the Canucks need here, right? And that's...
Yeah,
that's a big part of it. Like,
it's a huge, huge issue for them.
If you're tuning into any game around the league here, you will notice that almost every team is short. Every team is short a defender or two, and the Canucks are no different.
Yeah, you said you gave the four earlier in the show, and just like out of curiosity, I was like, I'll go to Daily Faceoff. Like, who are the Stars dressing on the blue line right now?
Oh, it's the
like
Stars
are Ilya Lyubushkin in the top four.
Well, no, but the Stars are hilariously unbalanced because one side looks great. Yep. And then what's the right side? Read all three.
Well, they have Heiskanen playing, I think, on his offside right now, but it's Lyubushkin, Dumba, and Brendan Smith.
Right.
And Heiskanen, and Lindell, and Harley on the left side. Yep.
So, I mean, that's a team that needs a righty. I think the Canucks would prefer a righty.
Yes, absolutely.
So there you go. I mean, that's another team you'd expect. Well, the Stars should think that they have a shot at winning it all, right?
Yeah, they absolutely. I'm sure they're definitely in. We're trying to win it all. No doubt.
I'm telling you, I watched that Colorado game against Washington, right? And Washington's become something of a curiosity for me, not just because they're the PDO champs of the early part of the season, but also because they're genuinely playing really good hockey. There's a really good vibe there. Pierre-Luc Dubois is making hustle plays. I don't even know what to do with myself. And I was watching them play Colorado.
That's Spencer Carberry, coach of the year right there. Pierre-Luc Dubois making hustle plays.
Dude, unbelievable stuff. And I'm watching them play the Avs. They roll into Colorado on the road, and they don't do anything to hard match MacKinnon. They're rolling out a Ferravari Trevor Van Riemsdyk pair against MacKinnon with zero hesitation, zero tricks, no juking the minutes to get the specific matchup you want. Just like Ferravari and Trevor Van Riemsdyk are going to be fine. And it just occurred to me that one thing that I'm so not used to covering this Quinn Hughes, Philip Hronek, Vancouver Canucks is how different the Canucks minutes look at the top of the lineup versus all of the other minutes, right? Like, the Canucks have a system, but they can only execute some things that they want to do offensively with their top pair on the ice. They're not just not able to do it with their other defenders on the ice as much as Erik Brännström has closed that gap to some extent. And I'm watching this Caps team, and it's like, oh, right, everything is the same no matter who's on the ice at the moment. And what a huge edge that is for a team like the Caps. I think it's a major reason why they're steamrolling teams right now.
Mm.
And I think, by the way, too, adding Lars Eller, seemingly a minor trade, gives them like Eller, Nick Dowd. Nick Dowd's awesome, right? By down the middle in their bottom six. And it's like, oh, wow, now they have it up front too. When I sort of saw the trade, I was like, yeah, I like Lars Eller more than most. That seems to make sense to me. But when you actually like watch them take line rushes or look at their lineup in line rushes, it's like, oh, man, they've just added that floor. This is just a team that's going about diligently raising their floor and able to play consistently, and in that way sort of has something in common with what we saw from Vancouver in the early part of last season.
Something else in common as well. Would PDO.
Right. Well, no, but the difference is actually the Caps are higher now at this point in the season than the Canucks were.
That's amazing.
But the Capitals need to hit a second peak 30 games in and then sustain that for another 30 games if they're going to completely break our brains.
I do think that point about just being able, like, not being afraid of your third pair. I guess that's just another way of stating what you said earlier in the show, right? But like, how many teams can say that they like have no concerns about their third pair?
Four. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's four.
Yeah. And everyone else is like, oh man, we got to manage these minutes.
Well, at the very least on the road, right? Like that's what's crazy. Like to go into Colorado where, you know, the fastball that the Avs throw at the top of their lineup in those MacKinnon, McCarman, it's only Edmonton surpasses it. Only Edmonton. And they didn't worry at all. They didn't fret, hesitate, do anything tricky. It was just roll our lines. What a luxury. That's a good team, man. And not that they're better than the Canucks, by the way. I actually think the Canucks have a way higher ceiling because Vancouver's elite players are better than Washington's elite players. But there is a huge edge, especially over an 82-game regular season. Maybe it's diminished somewhat in the playoffs to being able to play that way. And certainly the Canucks, you feel it. You feel it when the Hughes-Hronek pair is on the ice versus their other pairs.
All right.
You just do.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll take a break here. Final segment of Canucks Talk coming up next here on Sportsnet 650. Here on Sportsnet 650, it's Jamie Dodd, it's Thomas Strands. We're live from the Kintec studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at dunbarlumber.com. And lots of texts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line throughout the course of the show. Of course, fans reacting to the pair of games over the weekend for the Canucks. An ugly win against the Blackhawks and then a loss against the Nashville Predators last night. And this one came in from Johnny Mack. And echoing, you know, we've talked about this, but echoing something I know a lot of people have front of mind at the moment. Johnny Mack texts in, Eric Brandstrom's top four potential should be tested with Filip Hronek on the second pairing. He says allowing Carson Soucy to regain his form with Quinn Hughes while moving Myers to the bottom six. That's Johnny Mack. We don't have to get into all of the specifics of that, but just, and I know
I'm open to it.
Well, but your colleague Harmon Dial wrote about, you know, Eric Brandstrom's minutes at the Athletic, I know as well, and just that idea of bumping Brandstrom's minutes up. And it's an interesting one because I think it's kind of undeniable that he needs to play a certain amount of minutes, right? Given how everyone else is playing on the blue line. And maybe this is purely a semantic thing, but for me, more minutes, yes. Top four role, I'd be pretty hesitant to try out, right? Like, that's such a classic thing, right? Where you see puck-moving defensemen have success in third-pairing minutes, they get bumped up to the top four, and then it doesn't go as well, right?
Yes.
So I'm always wary
and
of...
And not just in hockey, across sports, right?
Yes.
The rate stats star...
100%.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm always wary of putting too many eggs in that basket, right? Like, hey, see this guy who's getting it done in sheltered minutes, just massively increase his workload. So I don't want to go that far, but I think there is a balanced place you can get to where you are giving him a little bit more to do, hopefully without overextending him, because he, like, again, based on the other skill sets available to them right now and the way in particular with Susie Myers pairing is performing, I mean, Brandstrom's making a big positive difference for them out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's important though to note just how carefully
they're using him.
The third minutes,
yep.
The third pair's minutes have been used. Like, Brandstrom has faced a well below average rate of head-to-head ice time against opponents' top lines and opponents' top sixes. He's above average only against forwards 8 through 12 on the opposing team in minutes on a game-to-game basis. His minutes are so sheltered that he's actually below average against both first and second pairs and above average against third pairs. That is prescribed.
Yeah.
So I like what I'm seeing. I really like what I'm seeing. There is an extent to which I worry about messing with success. Like, this Brandstrom-Desharnais pair is perfectly deployed the way they're deployed. And, you know, at the cost that they're at, which is what, $3 million? That this team is getting massive returns, in my view, from the play of that pair as a duo in this sort of usage. When you sort of add what Desharnais can bring as a penalty killer into the mix, like as your consideration set, man, like this is this for me, what's going on the third pair works and what's going on the top pair works. And while what's going on the second pair is problematic, I sort of still fundamentally reject the idea that it's killing the team to the extent that you should mess with your fastball at the top of the lineup or what's been a really nice find for you on the third pair in terms of how Branstrom and Desharnais are you know doing in the prescribed usage that they've been doled out.
Yeah, and for me, if you want to loosen the reins a little bit on Branstrom and Desharnais on the third pair, right, and so the minutes for them creep up a little, like I'm talking marginal here, right, like you start to maybe let them creep up a little bit, you dial back the minutes for Susie Myers a little bit, I'm okay with at least trying that, right? That's not a radical departure, that's just kind of a gradual thing. He's already seen his minutes increase a little bit anyways. I think the idea that shuffling the pairings to put him in the top four and giving him top 4 minutes that entails and the assignments that entails, and that's going to be a long, medium, maybe even short-term solution to what's going wrong in your second pairing, I'm not buying that. And I think, look, stopgap things, things to try, you want to shuffle it, you want to send a message to everyone and just shake things up a little bit, sure, whatever. But I don't see the second pairing solution in-house right now. And I don't think it's Eric Branstrom. As good a story as he's been, as well as he's played, as productive as he's been for the team, I just don't see it in-house.
I agree with you, but I'd add that I'm concerned. I'd be concerned about, I think people have to really be in it's fun to do the, we always do it, right? They're for a reason. It's fun to do the what this looks like on paper, different alignments thing, how it could work. But I really think we need to make sure to understand why the Canucks are right to be as protective as they have been of their fastball. Okay. They have a weapon in what Hughes and Hronek are doing as a pair that should be safeguarded. It can't, they shouldn't be picked away at even on the margins to address, you know, a second pair that has struggled, but not in a way that is actually like killed or harmed their ability to win games, in my opinion.
It struggled pretty mightily.
It struggled pretty mightily, but again, not to the point that you should be like,
that's different things, right? Because it has hurt their ability to win games. That what you're saying, and I think it's a fair argument, is that doesn't follow that you then have to chip away at the really good stuff.
My point is if you are going to, like, you have to be, that third pair has to struggle far more than it has, I think, to get to a point where you're willingly cutting off your nose and eliminating. Like, for example, Carson Soucy, underlying numbers, we know that they're ghastly, right? Team has been outshot 82 to 134 with him on the ice and outscored 7 to 14 with him on the ice 5-on-5. So that's minus 7 by goal difference. But are you willing to, is that such an issue? And by the way, some of that is bad luck. Like, some of that is goaltending. In fact, a lot of it is goaltending.
But the shot differential, though, like that, speaks to a major issue beyond goaltending.
Sure, but if you think about it as a rate and consider that they've been probably pretty unfortunate, like, you don't want to be outshot like that, but we're only talking about 29 shots against per hour, 5-on-5. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, If Quinn Hughes is helping you generate a 12 shot per hour margin, right, 5-on-5, and Carson Soucy is getting outshot by a similar margin but at a lower rate, you're still coming out ahead, and that's sort of where we're at. Like, the Canucks are generating, for example, this is per Hockey Viz, 3.17 expected goals for with Quinn Hughes on the ice, 5-on-5, and 2 without. They are literally twice as dangerous offensively with Hughes on the ice as they are without him. I mean, I don't even know. You have to keep that fastball. You still want to upgrade what you're getting off the second pair. Don't get me wrong. But you can't do it at the expense of what's working.
Well, and it's the flip side of the Branstrom conversation where it ends up with the same point, which is that the solution is going to be external at some point. Like, there, it's just, we've, I mean, I don't know how many times we've talked through different permutations of the blue line, and there's just nothing that is so compelling as you to as you say, break up what's working at the top of your lineup. Like, there's nothing that screams, ooh, we got to try this with the pieces they have available. So the solution at some point is going to have to come from outside.
100%. One thing to note that we haven't talked about a lot, but I think we should, is, in some ways, if you look at like the last 10-game segment that the Canucks have played. Now, what? We're 15 games in? 16?
Yeah.
Is that right? 15 or 16?
I don't know. Whatever. Close enough.
We're nearly
we're
half.
We're 17 games in.
17 games in. We're getting past halfway to the point where we'll start to talk to this about this team with some certainty. And there's actually some signs, I think, that this team's defensive game, which got off to, again, not a bad start, but a bad start relative to the standards that this team set last season. So judging this team only against their own tremendous metamorphosis into an elite defensive team, their defensive game became something like only average in terms of denying inner slot shots through the first 10 games or so of the year. The last 10 games, though, as like a segment, I think this team's lockdown defensive game, the oxygen in their contests has been far more successfully removed by the Canucks. I actually think their defensive game is trending in a really strong direction here, but it's been hidden because at 5-on-5, especially, this team's save percentage is in the 880s, right? Like,
yep.
We've seen Kevin Lankinen, I mean, we're only like 10 days removed from Kevin Lankinen having a 930 save percentage. He's down to 902. Like, he's down back to his career rate. This team's goaltending, I think, is making a lot of what we're seeing feel more frustrating, right? Because there are just more goals against. And I didn't think he was poor last night, by the way. Like, Stamkos making two of those shots from that spot.
Yes.
Guess what? That's going to happen sometimes.
That happens, yep.
That guy is unbelievably sick. But the truth is that there have just been more breakdowns that we're noticing because they're ending up in the back of the net, and that causes fans to react emotionally, and that means that you see the slow motion replay of the
yeah,
goal.
Yeah, you pour over it, and you see where everyone went wrong and all that. Yeah.
And there's a lot of this that... So I bring this up because Demko's return, I think now, his imminent return, as it was put by Darren Dreger today, but you know, from what I'm seeing in from what I've seen in practice occasionally, it still looks like the pace. There's probably still another step here in terms of ramping up the pace at which he's playing at practice before he gets in actual game action. But that's it's a storyline here, because I do think even just finding a way to manage Lankinen's minutes a little bit more might benefit him. Right?
Oh, absolutely. To get him into, like, even though, even if it's a 50-50 split,
yeah,
that's dramatically different than what he's been doing.
He's been used like a workhorse starter.
Absolutely.
I mean, the Canucks haven't played as many games as some teams, but guys made 13 starts. played a lot of games. You know, there's only 13 goalies in the sport that have made more saves. Only 10 that have played more games. So he's being rolled out as a workhorse, like an above average workhorse starter. So spotting him some rest and then getting a Vezina caliber goaltender, even if it takes Demko a minute to get back to his game, right? To find that timing, to find that dominant form that he's so regularly had in a Canucks jersey, that'll be a huge help here from the perspective of Vancouver's goaltending. I think it might also allow us to see some of this team's defensive improvements a little bit more clearly, because I guess as much as I've had concerns about some of the like specific details with which this team has executed, some of the focus, discipline, we've talked at length about the vibes. You know, I get the sense anyway that Rick Tocchet seemed pretty frustrated over the last 5 days. And as much as all of that concerns me, and the performance against Chicago concerned me more than the Nashville game, I think under the radar, there's some stuff where our perception, right, and sort of the frustration level that maybe is combining to create this dynamic is largely the result of maybe too many mistakes going uncovered by Canucks scores.
I'll also say, I mean, you just look at that game yesterday, right? And I'm not trying to say, oh, they actually played really well. They didn't. But if we're just talking about like 5-on-5 defensive form, right? You look, you check the score at the end and it's 5-3. It's an empty netter and it's two power play goals.
Yep.
Right? 5-on-5, it's not like it was a dominating performance from Nashville. It wasn't a leaky 5-on-5 performance by the Canucks. Now, again, I'm not trying to mount a defense of the effort or anything like that or say they deserve to win, but I think to what you're saying is, as we're like, the criticisms are mounting about so many different things that that aspect is getting thrown into it as well, and there have been concerning points this season on it, but it's still probably the strength of the team that's maybe just not getting in the spotlight as much because of the goaltending issue, right? But like, as you said, right, go at least since the start of the California road trip, you've seen more evidence of that baseline, and they're going to have to get back to that, right? And they're going to have to make that, if not quite as elite as it was last year, something pretty close, I think, to get out of the malaise, to fix the vibes, right? Like, that's one way to fix the vibes, is to get back to doing at an elite level the thing you did in an elite level last year. Get everyone feeling good for that reason.
And I think what I'd suggest is that they're actually sort of working toward it. Like, there's actually evidence that that's come, that part of their game has come alive, and maybe has escaped my notice anyway, just watching the games the last couple weeks, in part because more mistakes are finding the back of the net.
I think
goalies are making fewer saves.
I think like a statement, whatever you want to call it, statement, comfortable win, blowout win over a good team would go a long way for everyone. I think it would go a long way for the players. I think it would go a long way for the fans watching this team, right? Like a 4-0 shutout
against the Rangers.
You know, I'm not even saying the Rangers.
Okay.
Right. But just like at some point,
you're asking a lot.
No. I know. But like, if Demko's back, right, and one of the first few games he plays really well or something like that. But there's just, to bring it back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, there hasn't been a lot of like, wow, that was awesome games. There haven't been really any. You know, people point out that second period they played against the Penguins, they score a bunch of rush goals in a row. Like, that's a fun moment, right? We also, the Penguins are one of the worst teams in the league, particularly defensively, right? So there's that caveat. But again, if we're talking about vibes, like, well, how do you increase the vibes? You go have a statement, really strong performance against a good team, right? Where there's nothing to nitpick. There's no like, oh yeah, but that team's not very good or whatever. You just go and you put together a really solid performance. And that's what we're still waiting to see here on November 18th, 17 games into the season for the Canucks.
So another thing I wanted to talk about really quick. Sorry, I know we're running a little shy on time.
It's not like I've got other stuff planned. I don't care. You fill the final 5 minutes. Go nuts.
We talked a little bit about how the Canucks penalty kill was looking good. And their power play was deeply concerning.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about that Sharks game, right? After they had the New Jersey game where they looked just completely hapless and gave up the shorthanded goal and couldn't get set up. And it was really ugly on the power play. I think the Canucks have sustained a pretty good level on the power play now for a couple weeks, most of this month. And that's a good sign because some of the underlying stuff that we were looking at for the Canucks 5-on-4 on the power play was like disturbingly bad. It's come back alive. Like, their shot rate over the last little bit has been closer to average. Their attempt rate has peaked over 100. Remember, it was like under 70 shots an hour. Like, it was abysmal for the first 45 minutes that the Canucks were on the power play, or something like that. 30 minutes on the power play. They're still obviously gifted finishers up and down the lineup, so they're still shooting an incredible clip. And that Pettersson goal was so sick last
night. That was awesome. Yeah.
It was just so sick. Like, it was just such an exceptional skill play with some persistence and some quick puck movement. And, you know, one of the things that I think you can watch, if you want to watch and understand when the Canucks power play is clicking or why it's been better now than it was earlier in the year, as much as just getting set up is a big part of it, holding the puck versus moving it quickly, I think, has been the biggest change. The Canucks are moving the puck so much more and playing so much more directly, and you're just seeing way less time like with a guy spinning on the flanks as opposed to just like quickly getting rid of it and moving about the ice. I think that's been the biggest change, and I just felt like the Pettersson to Hughes, right back to Pettersson, the snapping it around with that level of purpose and intent, that's what you want to see from the Canucks 5-on-4. It was good to see. But I also think that was a long time coming. The other side of this coin, though, is Vancouver's pressure PK, which looked really good to me, has also been trending in the wrong direction. They're mm-hmm. surrendering way more shots. Teams are getting set up way more easily. And obviously the, you know, JT Miller pointing around while the Canucks get seamed and on looked bad last night and became sort of a flashpoint when Miller got benched. I don't know if I have an answer beyond this. Less Nils Amon in the lineup is actually problematic for the Canucks 4-on-5. I know that sounds wild to say, but he's really good. Like, yeah. He's a really good penalty killer. The moment you have, like, more Amon, more Joshua once he gets, you know, ramped up a little bit, obviously Teddy Bluger, Pew Suter, the moment you have more of those guys and a little bit less of Vancouver's stars typically has been, like, a winning ingredient for this group. But right now, I don't know that they have the roster construction for it.
Patterson has been at his best on the PK as kind of like the late PK option coming over, usually not taking a faceoff, but like he can disrupt in the neutral zone.
The old Max Pacioretty role.
Yeah. Now he's being used more as, hey, you're the second rotation out there, right? And JT Miller, who at the beginning of the season was used very sparingly on the penalty kill, has worked his way back into the rotation as well. And I wonder if it's just a little too much responsibility right now, given the physical limitations.
Well, and I'm a little gun shy after JT Miller. I was like, I don't know if he's a center. He's a really good center. I don't know if he's a good defensive center. He's a really good defensive center. I'm not going to be like, JT Miller can't kill penalties.
Because,
you know, the guy's clearly working and smart and gifted, and I don't want to lose another one. So I'm not going to. But what I would say is, for the most part, across the last few years, as the penalty kill's been a talking point locally, you know, I don't know that Miller's been part of the solution. And in fact, Vancouver's penalty kill's best moments have tended to come when his minutes are prescribed pretty heavily, shorthanded. Without him on the roster, though, I honestly, like, I know it's wild, but his length and speed and just intelligence, he's a really disruptive PK guy. I kind of think they're missing it right now.
Yeah, and look, as we talk about, I mean, we're talking about external options on the blue line. That's going to be on their shopping list. We've mentioned this a lot, right? Not just the right-handed faceoff winner, but the guy who can, another guy who can go out there and take faceoffs for you and do a really good job on the penalty kill.
For sure. The fourth line center, the right-handed centerman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's for sure a secondary option, but I do think lingering behind the defense. And then, you know, I do think guys like Filip Hronek, who have played more often for Vancouver on the penalty kill, have played really well there. I think Hronek's had some moments where you've noticed his rush defending for the wrong reasons over the last couple weeks, but you know, he's been pressed into a bigger role shorthanded than he had last season this year. I think that's looked good on him and on the Canucks. I also think it's the one area where Myers and Soucy, especially early in the year, were playing well.
Yes.
So that's why it's concerning, too, that that's falling off as the second pair continues to struggle at evens.
That is the show for today. Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow on Canucks Game Day here on Sportsnet 650.